I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. There was another mass shooting this week on Sunday when Devin Patrick Kelly killed 26 parishioners and wounded 20 more who were worshiping in Sutherland Springs Baptist Church in Texas. The youngest victim was 18 months old. Eight members of one family were all killed. Law enforcement said the shooting appeared to involve an ongoing domestic situation involving the shooter and his second wife and her family. A little bit later in the show, we'll talk about the connections between domestic violence, mass shooting, and gun laws. These shocking and all too familiar massacres often devolve into familiar and scripted debates that frankly go nowhere. Is there common ground on preventing gun violence? And we asked Lily Raff McCullough to join us. She's a hunter, also a member of Gun Owners for Responsible Ownership. And Lily Raff McCullough, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
Your organization was started about 5 years ago in 2012 in response to a shooting in Portland, Oregon. I'm just curious what your thoughts are today.
It's sad going through another one of these shootings. And one of the things that's saddest to me about it is just how familiar this has become. You know, we can all kind of predict what everybody's reactions are going to be at this point, from the president to, you know, the NRA to lawmakers on both sides of the aisle. It's just kind of here we go again.
Yeah, which is frankly why we wanted to have you on the show. What does your group aim to do?
Our group is trying to give responsible gun owners a voice in the gun debate, and it's also trying to find some apolitical things that we can do to help reduce gun violence. A lot of the mass shootings that get the most coverage in the news actually represent just a tiny, tiny fraction of the about 38,000 gun deaths a year in the United States. The vast majority of gun deaths in the United States are suicides, and then also domestic violence-related incidents, which it sounds like this latest mass shooting in Texas kind of falls into that category.
You mentioned the fact that there are these then familiar scripts and debates that happen, but is your organization in response to the gun lobby that has so much influence in Congress and in many ways defines the debate for people who own guns?
We're a really small startup organization that's all volunteer-driven, and we're a 501c3, so at this point we do very little lobbying. We do have a political action committee arm of our organization, but everything that we've done so far has, for the most part, focused on apolitical solutions to reducing gun violence, so things that we can do that don't involve legislation. And there's a lot that can be done just by responsible gun owners themselves, making sure that we store our guns properly by locking them when they're not being used, keeping the ammunition separate. These kinds of steps are simple, but they're really important and can help keep guns out of the hands of people who might use them to harm themselves or others.
Let me read your pledge here. You mentioned some of them. To take the pledge, I will practice safe storage. I will keep my firearms and ammunition locked and separate. I will support universal background check requirements. I will not sell or buy a firearm without a background check. I will support the rights of my fellow citizens to be free from intimidation by the open display of firearms in public. I will avoid the unnecessary carrying of firearms in public, particularly in places where children are present. I will always make gun safety a priority in my home, in the field, or on the range. And then the question is, will you take the pledge? How many people have taken this pledge?
That's a good question. I need to check with our web manager about that. I would guess we have, I don't know. That's a good question. I need to look into that. I want to make a point about the universal background checks.
Yes.
One of the points that we, or one of the positions that we hold at Gun Owners for Responsible Ownership, is that part of being a responsible gun owner is helping to keep guns out of the hands of people who shouldn't have them. And so that's a big category. Safe storage, which I've already talked about, fits into that category, but so do universal background checks. One of the problems that we have in the United States is that some states like Oregon have very strict laws about background checks. We've actually closed the so-called gun show loophole. So even a private gun sale needs to have a background check. And you can go to a firearms dealer, and they can, for a nominal fee, something like $5 or $10, perform a background check and basically legitimize the transaction of selling a gun to somebody who's outside of your family. And this is something that's really important, that all of the states in the United States follow these kinds of guidelines. We really need federal law that makes the background checks universal, so that it's not so easy to just go across state lines and get around some of the gun laws in this country.
We'll be talking a little bit more about domestic violence. Does that also figure into your pledge?
Yeah, it does, and I think that it's another example where safe storage and background checks are just so important. You know, really, when you look at even mass shootings, I think one analysis that I saw recently looked at mass shootings between 2009 and 2015, so 6 years of mass shootings, and found that 57% of the incidents in the United States were domestic violence related. So they were somebody who went on a mass shooting, basically with the motivation of shooting a domestic partner and or a romantic partner. And it's, this is one of several things that we could really be addressing better with existing gun laws and possibly with new gun laws, too.
You're a hunter. Do you think hunters have a different relationship with guns and how they see guns and perhaps even how they see efforts to try to regulate or control guns?
I do. I think that oftentimes hunters have a very different relationship to guns and to gun laws than, say, somebody who owns weapons for self-defense, or even a sport shooter or collector of firearms. I think that there are a number of reasons why hunters are kind of in this, we occupy this kind of middle ground that I think makes us uniquely suited to help move the gun debate forward. I think that one of the reasons that hunters are really valuable in this kind of debate is because we already are subject to a lot of laws that regulate how we can use guns. And I think that hunters, for the most part, accept that these laws are necessary and effective and important. And so we understand that you can have some gun laws without having overreaching gun laws. And I think that that level of trust, or that vision, whatever you want to call it, that vision for compromise is really important in this debate, because it seems like where we are now is a group of people calling for new gun laws and then a group of people who are resisting that call by basically saying that, by making the slippery slope argument that any new gun law is going to result in a loss of all guns.
Let me quote something that Nicholas Kristof has in the New York Times. It's a really exhaustive analysis of gun violence in the U.S. And one of the things he thinks is a better approach is a public health approach. But he also says here, the left sometimes focuses on gun control, puts that in quotes, which scares off gun owners and leads to more gun sales. He says a better framing is gun safety or reducing gun violence. Now, that seems like a semantic argument, but do you think we need different and better language in order to come to some kind of consensus?
I think that is actually a really important point, and it's one that our organization really believes strongly in. I also think that there are so many things that we can do. I agree that a public health approach is probably what's required right now, and I also think that one of the things that gets lost a lot of times in this debate is how much we could do to prevent gun violence without even passing any new laws. I mean, the initial reports of this particular incident in Texas really, really help highlight that, because this is a person who really shouldn't have been able to legally purchase firearms according to existing laws, and yet he was able to. That's just one example of, that's an area that needs to be investigated, and something needs to be done there, even without passing new laws. But there's so much that could be done just in terms of, I know I keep bringing up safe storage, but it's so important. I mean, here in Oregon, I've seen statistics that we have 26,000 children in Oregon living in homes with loaded weapons that are unsecured.
Wow.
That's a tremendous public health risk that needs to be addressed. And even without addressing it through new laws, there's so much that we can do. My organization is just launching this pilot program where we're working with physicians and trying to train them on some basics about firearms and also teaching them neutral, non-judgmental ways that they can talk to patients about how firearms are stored at their home. It's a simple thing that could really save lives, and it's something that unfortunately a lot of physicians just don't know enough about firearms to feel comfortable talking to them with their patients or talking about them with their patients, and don't know, you know, if a patient does have firearms in the home and has questions about how they should be secured, a lot of times a physician doesn't know enough to be able to give advice on the topic. And so it's the kind of thing where with, you know, a couple hours of really simple training, we could then have a way of reaching a number of patients or gun owners with a voice that they respect and has some authority, and it could save lives.
Do you have some degree of optimism that we can come together on some of these issues? I'm going back to Nicholas Kristof's piece, and he says these are things from a public health approach that he thinks would be effective: background checks, protection orders. He talks about ban under 21s. He talks about safe storage, which you just mentioned, straw purchases, ammunition checks, ending immunity, ban bump stocks, research smart guns. These are all ideas that he has. Do you think, building on what you said, and he said that there can be some agreement on where we go from here. Frankly, you know, I think like a lot of people, I feel very frustrated and worried, frankly, about the level of gun violence in this country.
I do, too. The thing that gives me the most optimism is that I really think that most Americans really have a common sense approach about this and really have rational beliefs about gun laws, safe gun laws. And so while I think that, you know, maybe we won't be able to get to everything on Nicholas Kristof's list, I think that he presents so many different solutions, and I think that so many Americans believe in them, that I think that we will get to those at some point. I think some of the things, like one of the things that he mentions that I think is so important, is restoring some research funding into gun violence. Mm-hmm. You know, we need to know, we need to have a clearer picture of the causes of gun violence, and ways that we can help prevent it. And that's just it's just a common sense area that the government should be funding. We should be learning as much as we can about how to prevent gun violence, so that when we do pass laws or we do fund programs to promote things like safe storage, we're spending those dollars in the ways that can be most effective and save the most lives.
Well, Lily, I hate to do this. Oh, I have to say goodbye to you. And I do thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. That's Lily Raff McCullough. She's a hunter, member of Gun Owners for Responsible Ownership. She wrote a book called Call of the Mild, Learning to Hunt My Own Dinner. We're going to take a very short break and then talk about this connection between gun violence and mass shootings and domestic violence. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. We're still learning about the massacre in Sutherland Springs Baptist Church on Sunday that killed 26 people, wounded 20, leaving the residents of that small Texas town in shock. We're also learning more about the shooter, Devin Patrick Kelly, who died on Sunday, reportedly of a self-inflicted wound. He had been court-martialed in 2012, sentenced to a year in military prison for assaulting his then-wife and stepchild, whose skull was fractured. He was given a bad conduct discharge from the Air Force, and he had sent threatening texts to his mother-in-law, who was a member of that Texas church, but did not attend on Sunday. The Air Force has admitted that it did not enter Kelly's name in the federal crime database that could have prevented him from getting a gun. People convicted of domestic violence are not allowed to purchase firearms. We asked Melissa Jeltson to join us. She's senior reporter for the Huffington Post, where she writes about violence against women. Melissa Jeltson, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. Also with us is Allison Anderman. She's managing attorney for the Giffords Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence. Allison Anderman, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you.
And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation. Melissa, I think we're all sort of reeling from the fact that it looks like this massacre was the result of a mistake, a glitch coming from the Air Force. What do we know?
Well, I think it's just a really startling admission from the Air Force that, you know, Devin Kelly was convicted of a domestic violence offense, and it was a fairly serious one. I mean, I looked at the court-martial papers. He pleaded guilty to strangling his wife, to hitting her, and to assaulting an infant child to the point where he allegedly cracked open the baby's skull. So that crime that he was convicted of should have prohibited him from purchasing firearms. And if he was in a civilian court, that would have naturally been the case. Because with military court, they don't have misdemeanors and felonies like we do in civilian court. But still, the offense would have counted under federal law for him not being allowed to purchase firearms. So it looks as though the Air Force never sent those records on to the FBI to be included in the federal background check system. I'm personally just completely shocked and wondering how many other similar cases there are out there. I mean, I'm trying to understand today how this happened and why there wasn't a process in place to make sure that people like Kelly, who we're recognizing are too dangerous to own firearms because of their domestic violence history, will fall through the cracks. I know there is a Department of Defense instruction that says once you have any sort of court-martial conviction, you must, you know, hand this information over to the FBI. So the question is, why didn't this happen? Is it a problem on the FBI side, on the military side, and how widespread is it? And then how are they going to fix this?
Well, Allison, you're a lawyer. This was the law as we understand it. What questions do you have?
Yeah, there are a number of questions that have been raised by this incident. However, I do want to point out that this is not an isolated incident, that states accurately and comprehensively reporting domestic violence records to the FBI for inclusion in the National Criminal Instant Background Check System, or NICS, is a problem nationwide. In 2014, the Center for American Progress put out a report looking at states' reporting of domestic violence records, so convictions and protective orders, which also prohibit someone under federal law, and found that only 3 states in the country comprehensively and accurately reported their records. And those states made up for the largest percentage of records in the NICS database. So it is important to look at what was the Department of Defense's policy, and was it an error? Was it not followed? Or is there a larger problem in how these convictions are recorded and how they are described, so that it is confusing for the people on the ground to know whether or not these convictions qualify under the Lautenberg Amendment and whether or not they need to be sent to the FBI? So those are 2 of the questions that we need to look at.
Well, I mean, that raises questions about, is it a linguistic problem? Is it bureaucracy? Is it that domestic violence is not taken seriously enough? Let me toss that first to you, Allison, but Melissa, I'd like your response as well. It just, you know, it leaves us all just frankly in shock as we try to understand what happened in Sunday in Texas.
I think it could be several of those things. I think in part it is a problem of disharmony between the way states write their domestic violence laws and possibly the military in this instance, and the way the federal domestic violence crime is defined in the Lautenberg Amendment. So there's a problem with states not having specific crimes of domestic violence, but rather having prosecuting those cases under general assault statutes, which then make it very difficult for people at the state and federal level to determine whether or not those convictions qualify. But I do think there is some hope here that laws that improve reporting of domestic violence records to the FBI seem to have bipartisan support in states around the country. And recently, there was a federal bill introduced by a Republican from Pennsylvania to incentivize states to do better reporting of domestic violence records.
Melissa, let me get you in on the conversation. If anything you want to add to what Allison said?
Yeah, I mean, I think at this point, we're still really need to investigate to find out what happened in this case and why the records weren't sent over. I don't necessarily think it's because a domestic violence conviction is not taken that seriously, but that there was maybe some problem in how the information was screened when it got to the FBI. But I think it does point to a bigger issue, which is, you know, Congress has recognized that, you know, domestic abusers are dangerous when they're armed. And that's why under federal law, even those convicted of a misdemeanor, so, you know, a more minor crime, are not allowed to own them. So that's a really special exception. But across the country, you know, in many states, abusers are still able to access firearms because these laws are not implemented and they're not enforced. And in many cases, even once convicted abusers are convicted and lose their gun rights, there's no process in place to actually make sure that they're disarmed. And I know I've spoken to many, many victims who say, you know, my ex-partner is not allowed to own firearms, but I know that he still has them, but there's no one that's going to actually go into his house and search for them and remove them, and then who's going to store them and who's going to pay for that. So even though we have it on paper that these people are dangerous and shouldn't be armed, in reality, they're remaining armed all over the country. And I think it's important to note that, you know, of course, domestic violence kills many women and families all the time, but it's also has been connected to the majority of mass shootings in this country. I mean, we know that if you're considering a mass shooting as four or more killed in a single incident, you know, a majority of them involve a perpetrator targeting an intimate partner or a family member. And a lot of these shootings don't make national news because they happen inside the home, you know, behind closed doors, and there aren't strangers who are targeted, so it seems maybe like a more contained situation. People aren't afraid of it, but these are happening all the time. So when we think about mass shootings as this American problem, it really is a domestic violence story. It's men killing their families, and then sometimes, like in this case, you know, killing random other people as well. But even in this, for Kelly, I think it's really important for us to remember, he didn't just target a church that he had no connection to. This was his wife's family's church where his mother-in-law went. He killed his wife's grandmother. This was clearly related to the family. And, you know, this horrible, tragic situation where so many people died was really, you know, an extension of a domestic violence situation.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Melissa Jeltson. She's a senior reporter for the Huffington Post, where she writes about violence against women. Also with us, Allison Anderman, and she's a managing attorney for Giffords Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence. Obviously, we are talking about what many people are talking about, which was the massacre on Sunday at Sutherland Springs Baptist Church in Texas. 26 people were killed, 20 wounded, some really serious wounds as well. The shooter reportedly killed himself after being chased by some members of this town, who, one of whom had actually shot him a couple of times. We are talking about what to do in response to the numbers of mass killings that we've been learning about. And of course, there's the day-to-day violence related to guns as well. And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Allison, let me go back to you, and I've been quoting from Nicholas Kristof, who had a pretty extensive piece in the New York Times looking at a more public health approach to the problems of gun violence in this country. And he listed some really interesting polling numbers. And these are people who own guns and whether they agree with the following statements. I'll just read a couple of them. Background checks for all gun buyers. 93% of gun households say absolutely. Preventing the mentally ill from buying guns. 89% said yes. Nationwide ban on the sale of guns to people convicted of violent crimes. 88% of gun owners said yes. Barring gun purchases by people on no-fly or watch lists, 82%. So I think people get the idea that there is this, there is common ground here. What do you think prevents us from coming to some kind of resolution on this?
Yes, you're absolutely right that most Americans overwhelmingly support sensible, evidence-based gun violence prevention policies. And I think the barrier to enacting these laws is federal legislators, essentially. We've had a lot of success at the state level in states where there is a greater concern for the safety of communities than there is for gun industry profits. But unfortunately, we don't see the same things at the federal level, despite the fact that these legislators' constituents overwhelmingly support these policies. And we really need legislators to have the courage to stand up to the gun lobby and say, I'm going to do what is in the best interest of my constituents and what they want, rather than the industry that's going to donate to my campaign.
It's so interesting to me. And we were talking with a hunter gun owner at the top of the hour. If you're talking about the gun lobby, if you're talking about the NRA, I think it has a membership of something like 5 million people. So most people in this country who own a gun do not belong to the NRA. What, Allison, gives it such power?
I think the gun industry. I think the NRA has evolved in the last 50 years from being a really membership-driven organization of people interested in hunting and gun safety to one that is essentially a lobbying arm for the gun industry. You know, you can see that in the position changes that they've made over the past 30 years. They used to absolutely support background checks and recognize that background checks were a no-brainer when it came to preventing dangerous people from acquiring firearms, to the present day where they fight against every background check bill that gets introduced either at the state or federal level. And I just also want to pivot back for one second to address the point that irrespective of the failures of the Air Force to report the shooter's record to the FBI in Texas, he, even if they had reported that record, he could have purchased that same exact gun from a private seller without a background check. And that is a huge loophole that we need to close to really continue to make strides in gun violence prevention.
Melissa, I want to pick up on something you said, and then we'll get some callers and some commenters in on the conversation. You talk about, and others have found this connection, obviously not all domestic violence cases result in mass shootings, but there is a connection there. Help us understand the psychology about why someone who was abusing their family would become a mass shooter. What is the connection there?
Well, I think it is. It's a complicated subject. I think domestic violence is really about power and control. And if you can imagine going into a public space and shooting a bunch of people, it's an ultimate act of power. You're taking away people's lives. In many cases of these domestic violence-related mass shootings, we see the perpetrator really losing control of his family. Maybe the wife is leaving. Maybe he's lost his job. There's a divorce happening, and it's a way of kind of reaffirming the power. And I think it's also about seeing your family as really just your property and an extension of yourself. But it's hard to understand. I've talked to some experts because we also see a history of violence against women in the backgrounds of many sort of other mass perpetrators of violence, so like terrorists. And some crime experts will say that even those who are going to go on to be extremely violent to the public might practice that violence on the people closest to them first and become desensitized to it before sort of lashing out. Like, it's hard to kill a bunch of people. It's not a natural thing for people to do. So you might work up to that a little bit by perpetrating violence against your own family.
Wow.
But I think there's still a lot that needs to be known
about
know.
This issue. NPR was reporting this morning that apparently he had at least a dog that he would abuse. Mm-hmm. Is there a connection, Melissa, about a minute before our break here, but is there a connection between abusing animals and domestic violence?
Yeah, I think there's been some research on that, connecting sort of that cruelty towards animals with violence against those, in the family. So that is considered a red flag. Maybe we can revisit. I'd love to talk about the actual assault. There's some details of his assault on his wife.
Oh, well, we have about 45 seconds. Is it possible to do it then, right now?
Maybe when we come back.
Okay, that's fine. And I'll let you get your cough taken care of. That's Melissa Jeltson, senior reporter for the Huffington Post. She writes about violence against women. Also with us is Allison Anderman, and she's a managing attorney for Giffords Law Center to prevent gun violence. And we are, of course, talking about what happened in Texas on Sunday. And I read that something like 10% of that community, I think about 40 people live there, affected by the mass shooting that took place in Sutherland Springs Baptist Church. And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And stay with us. Much more to talk about after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, talking with our guests about the gun massacre in Texas and the connections between gun violence and domestic violence and what can be done about it. Melissa, we have a lot of people that want to join us, but if you could just help us understand a little bit more about the shooter and what he did to his, I don't know whether it was his current wife or his first wife.
Yeah, it was his first wife. I just think it's important to note in the court-martial documents, it talks about how he pled guilty to strangling her. We know that strangulation is a really important key indicator of future homicide. So when we're looking at domestic abusers across the country, there's something called a lethality assessment, which can look at those who are the most dangerous. And one of the critical things they look at is a history of strangulation. So putting your hands around someone's neck and cutting off their air has been found with research to be connected to a much higher rate of later going on to commit homicide. And so he had that strangulation in his history. And I think that across the country, there's been a real push to make strangulation a felony level offense, to recognize that people who are willing to do that are quite dangerous. So I thought it was really interesting once I was finally able to get the documents on him, that was in his history that he had strangled. So it's a very serious offense. It's almost an attempted homicide to put your hands around someone's neck like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, no question about that. Allison, do we need more research when it comes to guns, gun ownership, use of guns, storage of guns, all of that?
Absolutely. We need more research into gun violence prevention. There is a very disproportionately low amount of funding being devoted to what is essentially a public health crisis in our country, and the numbers are only increasing. We had a record number of people killed by guns last year in 2016 at around 38,000, and we are not seeing funding devoted to this issue like we are other issues that produce a similar number of casualties each year in our country.
Let me get, looks like Bob from Reading to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Bob. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. Go ahead.
Okay. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'd like Allison, Melissa, and yourself to address this issue. we always go through this cycle of pain whenever there's one of these incidents, but nobody ever comes up with a creative way to prevent them. And I think I might have something here.
Go ahead.
If you don't eulogize these people and these lunatic type behaviors, if you don't say who it is, just say there was an accident and this number of people were wounded or killed, but don't tell them what the guy's name is. Don't tell them where he's from. Because maybe we're all so seduced by celebrity in this society that that's what they're after. In many cases, they want celebrity. So take the celebrity away from them. Don't say on the radio who they are.
Well,
just
Bob,
leave them anonymous. I'll take my answer off the air. I want to hear it on the phone.
Yeah, me too. Thanks for calling into Radio Times. Melissa, let me toss this back to you because of the work that you do understanding about domestic violence. Is celebrity, do you think, what, if we're talking about someone like the killer that we're talking about today, is celebrity a factor?
It very well may be, and I totally understand Bob's point. But for me as a reporter, I really don't like to say this information that I have that my readers shouldn't have. I feel like that's quite paternalistic. So I understand not celebrating them. Oftentimes with a mass shooter, they will have taken these sort of like glamour shots with them and their weapons. Like I agree that we shouldn't be publicizing photos like that because clearly that was their intention. We can find other photos of them to use. We should be careful when we're, you know, publishing excerpts of their manifestos and that kind of stuff. But I personally think it's important to understand the shooters and their motivations, and that means knowing who they are and looking at their background. So I get the motivation behind saying, like, let's just make them invisible, but I think that we actually need to look at them and understand them to be able to prevent these in the future.
Yeah, and I tend to agree with you, Melissa. What are your thoughts, Allison?
I agree with what Melissa is saying. I also agree with the caller that it is language is really important, and how we talk about these shootings is important. And within the gun violence prevention movement, we do try very hard not to refer to shooters by name, and you will very infrequently hear me say a shooter's name for this, the very reason that the caller brings up. And I think that it is an important thing to be cognizant of.
And I appreciate, Bob, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let me get Brahim from Delaware County to join us on Radio Times. Brahim, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is basically, I know this mass shootings that happen in Las Vegas or New York or in Texas, to me is like they're like sick people. But every time we see on TV, if someone from another country or his name is maybe associated with the Islam, we call them terrorism. Mm-hmm. But if someone that's not claiming that is Muslim or whatever, even though the Islam doesn't call for that, do we call it, we say he's sick-minded or maybe he's not taking his pills, or we try to find another way, but we don't call it, even though if you go to dictionary, the word terrorism or terrorize it applies to all those sick people. Terrorize the kids, and they kill innocent people for no reason. It doesn't matter what they're from and where they belong to.
Well, Brahim, let me take your comment and actually put it to you, Allison, because you talk about it's important that we use the correct language. My understanding with terrorism, when talking about terrorism, is that it has a political motive or message. Terrorizing a family, I would assume in many ways we might be talking about what happened with this particular person.
Yes, I agree with that. I also agree with Brahim, however, that we as a society are too quick to make the distinction of terrorist or otherwise, you know, non-terrorist but otherwise evil person based on someone's nationality or religion, and that these labels are not always thrown around accurately, and that is a big problem and something that we really need to be mindful of and work hard to not fall into that trap.
That's Allison Anderman, and she's a managing attorney for Giffords Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence. Melissa Jeltson, senior reporter for the Huffington Post. She writes about violence against women or domestic violence. And you can join us, as Brahim did, by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me read a comment from a listener. I'll put this to you, Melissa. He said, I was convicted of abuse of my family. It was a dark time. Suffered from depression. He found no support system for him. Was ostracized. What support is there for individuals who are trying to get treatment? And I would say if you're here in the Philadelphia area, the Joseph J. Peters Institute is a place you should check out. But Melissa, is this a problem, you think, that people might be identified but not getting the help or the treatment that they need?
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think that we should ostracize people who commit violence. I think that people can change and deserve to have support and community. I mean, there are better intervention programs. Yeah, like you said, I'm not sure where this man is located and what support system is available for him. But I would say that at least in my work, when I write about domestic violence, I do it with the understanding that in many cases, victims want to remain with their partners. They just want the violence to stop, and that there are ways that there can be reunification and support for the abusers. And, you know, they don't necessarily deserve to spend the rest of their lives in prison or anything like that. But I do think that it's important for us to acknowledge that if they have a qualifying conviction that, you know, gun ownership shouldn't really be in their future.
And there was something you mentioned earlier, and I believe I ran across this, talking about the relinquishment gap, which is someone who has been convicted of domestic violence cannot purchase a gun, but that doesn't mean that they don't have guns in their house because they literally have not been disarmed. Is that correct?
Yeah, in many states, there is no procedure in place once a person becomes prohibited from owning a gun to actually remove those guns from the person. And even if they did remove them, they might not have anywhere for the guns to be stored. And then who's paying for that storage? So there's all sorts of just sort of basic instructions or procedures that need to be set up in order to make sure that people who are prohibited from owning guns no longer have them. And I know just talking to victims, that's often a really big fear. Even in New York, we just had about a week ago a woman right outside of my office who was shot to death by a guy that she dated, and she had a restraining order against him at the time. She had told the court, I know he's former law enforcement or, you know, maybe military, I'm not sure, and I know he has access to firearms. They went to court, and the man's lawyer said, oh, no, he doesn't have any, just said it, and then he ended up killing her with a firearm.
Oh, wow.
So it's often about the abuser self-reporting their guns, and there's, you know, no one's going into the house and searching for the gun or anything like that.
Which could be very dangerous for law enforcement, I can imagine. Let me get Margo to join us. Looks like she's calling from Delaware. Margo, go ahead. You're on Radio Times. Yes.
Yes. Hi, Marty.
Hi.
Thank
there.
You so much for covering this issue.
Sure.
You know, your guest, I happened to just tune in a little bit late, but was talking about the hardship in getting things passed in the legislature. And my comment just basically shares that back in 1989 and 90, I was in our state senate, and the governor and I worked very hard to get a check on handguns. We had no criminal check on handguns outside of what the original one, which was a very easy one, but in our state we had none. And all I can say is I think it's important the public know that I was threatened so terribly by the NRA.
Wow.
I actually have shotguns. My husband was a head of Remington, so I had no fear of guns, but I knew that something needed to be done, and had my life threatened in one place, and the NRA threatened me, and it became a big national issue because I was running for a special election. So, yes, the pressure was on back then, and I can only say I kept doing what I did, and we eventually got something watered down through our Senate, but it has since been all erased with what's happened over these years.
Well, that's a really chilling story, and I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let me give Allison Anderman a chance to respond. Allison, your thoughts?
That is very disturbing, of course, and I'm really sorry to hear that you had that experience, but I thank you also very sincerely for your efforts to improve the laws in your state. And I do want to point out that just like Margot, and despite the opposition that we faced from the gun lobby, since the massacre at Sandy Hook Elementary, states have passed over 200 laws that strengthen gun violence prevention. And many of those laws have done things like improve laws prohibiting domestic abusers from acquiring guns or reporting mental health records to the FBI for inclusion in the NICS database. And many of those laws were passed in red or purple states. So even though sometimes we can lose hope when we see what's happening at the federal level, there actually has been unprecedented momentum at the state level, thanks to people like Margot. And we are making progress on this issue in the state houses around the country. So there's reason to be hopeful for that and to keep moving forward.
Let me get one more caller in. Elena calling us from Cheltenham. And Elena, we're almost out of time here, but I just wanted to get you on for a brief comment. Go ahead.
I'm actually from New Jersey. Hi, Marty. My name's Elena Maria Lopez, and my husband had tried to kill me and then assaulted me with a firearm. Wow. I couldn't even get the Westchester police to bat an eyelash. The DA was interested in pressing charges, but once he spoke to the police, they wouldn't do anything. When I moved to New Jersey, I actually fled to New Jersey. They considered my case to be so serious that they put me in hiding, but they still couldn't press charges until he tried to kill me in New Jersey. So I just wanted to show that there's a disparity in terms of how localities as well as states handle domestic violence, including with a firearm. I couldn't get Chester County police or district attorneys to do anything.
Elena, I'm really glad you called. Obviously, it's horrifying to think that what you've been going through. I just want to give Melissa the last word. Melissa, final thoughts.
Yeah, Elena, I'm so sorry to hear that. Unfortunately, you know, I've heard that kind of story from so many women across the country, that it really is about your local law enforcement and where you are that will determine how seriously they take your case. I guess for last words, I just think it's so important for people to recognize that when guns enter a domestic violence situation, it's incredibly dangerous, both for the women, for their children, and also for the community, neighbors, and, you know, as we've seen in the Texas shooting, also just for the community at large.
On that note, Melissa Jeltsin, thanks for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Senior reporter for the Huffington Post, Allison Anderman, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. That's and she's managing attorney for Giffords Law Center to prevent gun violence. And we began our conversation talking with a member of Gun Owners for Responsible Ownership. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out much more about the program, including how to download a podcast of the show. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Trine Nuri. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you for joining us.